So Avihu Rosenzweig is a modern Orthodox rabbi in Israel, and he's really one of the pioneers of the intersection of mental health, mental illness, and Judaism. And he recently wrote this book, which is truly the first book, the first sefer, halachic sefer, which deals with mental illness in a real, serious, substantive way. There are other books that exist. There's this book I read this summer. I wasn't super thrilled about it, which is about like the halachot of psychotherapy. That like wasn't fantastic. There have been other works that have been written. There's an incredible professor at Bar Ilan who's a professor of social work. His name is Professor Moshe Levi Spiro, and he was the OG pioneer of like Torah and psychology. He's written a bunch of books about it. He is a professor in Israel, a psychoanalyst. So there is like some literature on this, but Rabioni wrote this sefer, which is really the first treatment of the halachot of mental health in a serious, substantive way that engages many of the challenges, halachic challenges that arise in the area of mental health and halacha. So I wanted to do, since Rabioni spoke this evening, I wanted to kind of do like a deeper dive into his sefer and about halacha and mental health. By exploring one of the forewords to his book. So in his book, he has, I think, like five or six forewords written by different leading rabbis in the Israeli community. And I wanted to learn together the foreword that Rav Re'im HaKohen wrote to Rav Yoni. So Rav Re'im is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Otniel in Israel, which is, Otniel is like pretty small yeshuv, pretty small community in like
Yehuda Shomron. Also known as a right to Shana Gimel.
Also known as a right to Shana Gimel, exactly. If you're like right for like half a Shana Aleph and then somehow, you know, make it to like Othniel, also like, you know, pre-army. So Othniel is also this incredible yeshiva where they're really into combining spirituality and serious Torah scholarship. They also embrace more academic approaches to learning Talmud. And so Othniel's an incredible yeshiva. So the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, is Rav Re'im HaKohen. And he is a really brilliant thinker. He's a posek halacha. He has written a lot of books on different areas of halacha. He wrote a book on, one book that I saw, it's actually on Sefaria. He has a sefer on the halachot of Shemitah. So Rav Re'im wrote this. So Rav Re'im is really one of the, you know, leading rabbis in the religious Zionist community in Israel. Head of Yeshivat Otniel, he learned at Yeshivat Har Etzion. He was a Talmud of Aaron Lichtenstein. So he wrote a introduction, a foreword, or actually in the book it's called a Divrei Bracha, words of blessing, to Rav Yoni's book, which I think is a really powerful exploration of some of the challenges, some of the halachic challenges involved in trying to map mental health into the existing halachic scholarship paradigms. Whereas Rav Yoni focused kind of more on the community aspect of mental health and less, de-emphasized, I would say, the halacha part. What I want to focus on here is halacha more as a solution, halacha as engaging in encountering people where they are in the realm of mental health. So I have here this double-sided sheet. I vocalized it. There's this awesome website. I don't know if I've mentioned this. There's this awesome website that was created by a professor in Israel that uses artificial intelligence to vocalize, put vowels on like Hebrew texts. And you have like an option to use like a modern Israel, like modern Hebrew, rabbinic Hebrew, and it uses different databases to vocalize the texts. So I have to say this. I typed all the Hebrew up on my computer and then plugged it into that system, so it's all vocalized. I'm proud of that. I've worked really hard on my like Hebrew typing skills. I want to go through the foreword to the sefer and kind of see how Rav Re'im tackles this question of mental health and halacha and the obstacles in thinking about mental health. So let's start. We're going to read in Hebrew. We also have also translated. I also wrote a rough translation on the left side. Ha sefer shekatav Rav Yoni Yonatan Rosenzweig Shlita mitmoded im nosei shahalacha ad ko kimat velo hitmodada ito. This book that Rav Yoni Rosenzweig wrote deals with, grapples with, a topic that in halacha, for the most part, hasn't encountered, hasn't really dealt with in a serious way, which is mikoma shel hanefesh, the place of the soul or the psyche, v'shel machalot hanefesh b'shikulim ha'ilchatiim, in dealing with the place of the psyche, of human psychology, of mental illness, in halachic deliberation. So I put a footnote here, which is that the language he uses here is machalot hanefesh, which is like really mental illnesses. But it's actually this sefer and the issue of mental health is much broader than mental illness. Mental illness, as a phrase, connotes the medicalized model of psychology, which was like one of the earlier and predominant views in psychology that kind of just used psychology in like medicine. So it's very, it's very medical in the sense that, you know, like if you have a medical condition, the solution to that is like taking medication, right, for example. So in the world of mental health, in psychology, that's not the only form of dealing with, mental health, mental illness. It's not just we're prescribing medication, but there's also different modalities, different types of therapy that exist. There's psychoanalytic therapy, which is about our thinking about our conscious and unconscious awareness and things that are beyond our conscious awareness. There's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is about analyzing the relationship between our thoughts and our feelings and our actions. So like these, there are different models of therapy, but also like not every person who goes to a therapist is like going because they have bipolar or they have some sort of anxiety disorder. That using the phrase mental illness, I think, is a little bit of a shortcoming because it doesn't touch the broadness or doesn't grasp the broadness of mental health, which is like people have challenges in their lives that they're coping with. They're not all pathologies. They're not all illnesses proper, but people are seeking help for things that pertain to their own mental health and well-being. So I think it's important that even though like this is the phrase machalot hanefesh, it's important to realize that really this is like a much broader discourse about mental health in general, and mental illness plays a role in this as well. Okay, so let's continue. So Rav Yoni says, and the Rav Reim says, "Av shemachalot hanefesh livoyeta enoshut me'az u'me'olam." Even though mental illness has accompanied the human condition from time immemorial, bedorot achronim chal shinoy atzum b'havanatan u'b'mudu'ut alehen. In recent years, in recent generations, there's been a much deeper awareness and understanding of mental illness and mental health. Moreover, in the past, a lot of people who had mental illness, they didn't have the opportunity to seek treatment because we didn't understand mental illness. We didn't have interventions. We didn't have treatments that were available for mental illness. However, nowadays, in our days, the domain of medical and clinical intervention has advanced significantly. Both in the identification and assessment of mental illness and in understanding mental illness and mental health. This renaissance in this renewal in our understanding of human psychology, of mental illness, of mental health and well-being, requires a new contemplation in halachic deliberation, hamvuseset al yisodot halacha, which is based on halachic principles, foundations. V'al pituach kelim hatoamim et havanat hanefesh u'machalotah. And on the development of tools, appropriate tools for understanding the soul and mental illness. In other words, what Rav Reim is saying, his first argument is that our advance as humanity, our advanced understanding of human psychology, of mental illness, of mental health, requires returning to the sources of halacha and seriously thinking about mental illness and seriously developing principles related to mental health and mental illness. So that's his first argument, which is that with a new reality, with our greater knowledge of this new area of human thought, it requires further contemplation.
I'm just curious to see the source sheet.
Yeah, Reb Josh, come in here.
No, I'm going back down in a minute.
It's all good.
Looking at the source sheet.
L'chaim.
L'chaim. Oh, Rabbi. Join the rest of us?
Yeah. Wouldn't be a mishmar without it. Okay. So now let's continue. Lemarocha habitui ahilchati. See you later, Josh. Lemarocha habitui ahilchati hamikubal dina fashot hibikuach nefesh. In general, we have this halachic expression that relates to life-threatening cases. We have this expression, we have this concept of pikuach nefesh, that if somebody's life is in danger, so there are certain things that we do to save them. Rov ha'isuk ha'kayam b'halacha hu refu'at ha'guf u'b'hatzalat ha'chaim v'lo b'tipol b'nefesh atzma. This is also really deep and profound. Most of this conversation, most of the halachic discourse around pikuach nefesh, about life-threatening things, is about physical danger, danger to one's physical life and health, and not about interventions relating to the soul or to the psyche. Right? So most of halacha that addresses life-threatening things, it's concerned about our bodies and our physical well-being and safety. And then he provides an example. He says, Kach l'dugma, take for example, but divrei Rashi, what Rashi writes, biyachas litipul u'da'aga lemi shenitkaf beruach ra'a. For a person who was overcome by a ruach ra'a, literally like a wicked spirit or an evil spirit, which was in the days in Talmudic times, they were aware of certain like mental illnesses. They didn't have a great understanding of them, but they were able to identify that like clearly something is pretty wrong, because this isn't how most people are acting. So he cites Rashi. Rashi commenting on the Mishnah, Tani said, "Mipnei ruach ra'a." Rashi comments, "Shenichnas bo ruach shida," that this demonous spirit entered someone. Viratz v'holich, and they are running and moving around. They're kind of running out of control. V'shema yitba b'nahar o yipol v'yamut. And perhaps they might drown in a river, or they might fall and die. Right? In other words, this person is possessed by this like spirit, which we would probably say is some sort of mental illness, maybe some like we'd call like, let's say, like positive symptoms of schizophrenia, as like hallucinations, things that when we say positive symptoms, we mean things that our brains aren't actually perceiving from the outside world, but rather our minds, our brains are creating themselves. So perhaps these people are seized by that type of spirit. And there's a danger that they might drown, or they might fall, they might do something dangerous, because they are not like really making this conscious decision. They're overcome by this some sort of like external force that's moving them to this action. Klomar, Rashi nogea rak bekach, Shabaya hanefashit matzricha tzipul mishum shihi mehaveh sakana laguf. In other words, Rashi is addressing this case of somebody who has a ruach ra, someone who's possessed by this evil spirit, and he's concerned about the danger to their physical safety, right? This person might drown. This person might fall and die. So this, even this case in the Gemara, it's not really, it's talking about somebody who has some sort of mental illness, right? But the concern, the halachic concern, is not about their illness or their experience of that illness, but rather it's concerned about the danger to the imminent physical danger to them, right? V'lo mikevan shi atzma koshi ubaya. Not because mental illness is in and of itself a challenge, a problem, something that causes suffering. Right, so Reim's second claim, his second argument is that classic halachic literature addresses, even when it comes to addressing mental illness, thinks about it in terms of immediate physical safety and danger. Right, so claim number one is, with our further human understanding of psychology and mental illness, we have to return to the sources of halacha in order to better understand mental illness and mental health. Claim number two is, even in halachic literature, which acknowledges and is aware of mental illness, it still only deals with the physical danger involved with people who have or experience mental illness, right? Which is a problem for thinking about people who have mental illness or thinking about mental health in halacha. Ein safik shashikul shel hatzalat haguf hu shikul ma'ashmuti gdolei haposkim asku b'kach. And Rav Raim says, don't get me wrong, physical danger is really important, and many rabbis, many poskim have dealt with this, have dealt with the question of pikuach nefesh and danger, life-threatening danger. That's clearly very important. Ulam kayom yeshna hakara b'uvda sheyesh lehitmoded lo rak im pain tsar v'sofani shal machalat nefesh ela im hachayim b'tzila. This is a beautiful line, Machayim Mitzila. He said, nowadays, we have a better, we have an acknowledgement not only of the fact that somebody who has mental illness is going to, like, just live a life of suffering and pain because, like, there's no way to intervene and there's no way to treat them, right? So they're just going to end up running around and they're going to have the psychological torment and suffering and also are going to have the possibility of of encountering some sort of fatality or dying, right? But nowadays, we don't live in the same situation where we didn't have any intervention that having mental illness meant having zero quality of life and potentially having life-threatening encounters and experiences frequently. But rather, nowadays, people live with mental illness or mental health, b'tzila, in the shadows. Right, and mental health is in the shadows of our existence. That we are at a point as a society that, like, we're able to live with mental health challenges or mental illness. There are people who have chronic depression that it's a type of depression which you can try to mitigate some of the symptoms, but it's something that you can't totally cure. Right, so. In a sense that you're always, if you have chronic depression, you're always followed by the shadows of that depression wherever you go. And so on a psychological level, we want to, a mental health professional wants to figure out how to help somebody in that situation be able to cope through life with those challenges of living with chronic illness. So we've shifted in our paradigm. We're not, we don't live in this fatalistic, we don't have this fatalistic existence where if you have mental illness, you're basically just going to live a life of suffering. But rather, we live in a society at a time where you can live with mental illness, and mental illness and mental health challenges remain in the shadow and remain a part of our lives. The alkein, and therefore, Rav Raim argues, mikorot alacha uskim be'etzem habaya hanafshit dalim ve'ina mufutachim dayam. Therefore, the current sources of halacha that deal with the problem, psychological illness, are impoverished and they're not fully developed enough. Because previously we were only concerned about people's physical life threatening danger with people who have mental illness, because there is no way for them to live with and cope with mental illness in a lifelong way. And now that we have a way of dealing with and coping with mental illness in a more advanced way, so the sources in the halachic literature that deals with this doesn't properly address or fully address our new reality. Okay? That is part one. Questions, comments, reflections. Jacob, the tone's awesome, by the way.
Thank you.
This liner, I don't know, Simcha liner.
I'm going to just start, putting them in. Yeah. That's what I said. You should start selling, a little sheath bottle full of little bits of them.
Yeah.
Extra crispy.
Yeah. We got to find, there's got to be, a brand of, chillin' liner, and that's, a really good,
We used to. Up until 3 weeks ago, this didn't happen. It was, we just got a new thing of liners.
Is this from the butchery, this liner? Where's this liner from?
Where are you from? Where's the liner from?
The butchery.
That's from the butchery. Where were we previously getting liners from?
Also from the butchery.
But did they change their...
No, but me and my brand. We bought, the previous batch we bought, a year ago at this point.
Yeah. Okay.
Quality's coming down.
Yeah, it is.
It's called manufactured. If there's a word for that.
planned obsolescence.
Manufactured obsolescence, yeah.
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 This is all done on Y.U. Torah.
This is all on Y.U. Torah. Michael Gull is now on Y.U. Torah. It's his first... well, maybe it's not his first appearance. He might have made appearance
in
Yitzi Blau's Sheer Chloe. It's a big big hop for Blau's Sheer Chloe.
Whenever someone makes a good point, they'd be like, it's on Y.U. Torah.
Exactly. Yeah,
I have a comment.
Yes.
I think the point that is raised, the description of Rashi, I just find it really interesting that there is no emphasis on, like, the kind of inner stress and inner harm being done on the person who's suffering from, like, a mental illness or, like, a kind of mental, like, episode, whatever, you know, that kind of means to, you know, Rashi at the time. I feel like that's really interesting that it's still brought to the physical rather than dealing with the spiritual, because I feel like it doesn't feel very on par with Rashi's typical writings. I don't know. It feels a little weird to have it really be targeted towards potential physical harm rather than like psychological harm. And I just wonder how he made that distinction and like how physical harm was emphasized over spiritual harm or mental harm.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Rav Raim is trying to underscore is that our paradigm of mental health and psychology, let's say in the last 200 years, is just like it's a paradigm shift from how people understood mental health and mental illness. Like people just didn't really understand it. They thought it was like something that, you know, like possessed people, but they didn't really. I'll say it differently. People weren't aware of the experience of mental illness in and of itself.
Also, just like the umbrella of mental illness has gotten a lot wider. I think in Rashi's time, the depression Rashi probably didn't have in mind like depression or anxiety or something where, you know, where you could be functional. Rashi probably has in mind someone who's like, you know, has like severe schizophrenia or something, you know, like a psychotic break, like something, you know, much more extreme as far as mental illnesses go.
I still don't really understand, though, why the main focus is still physical, even in that case, right? Because, like, if someone is going through a schizophrenic episode, like, I guess it really just goes back to that paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Like thinking of these people as being possessed rather than, like, going through, like, an actual episode.
Also, you forget, like, during these times that,
right,
like, it's not like physical ailments were being well treated either.
Right,
like,
yeah.
This
of course.
Is when someone would have a heart attack and they'd like bleed them to make their humor
right,
go back
right,
to life.
Right, right. Yeah, so I guess it's really all kind of chalked up to like the lack of kind of, I guess, like a different understanding of, yeah, what people are going through.
Yeah. And William James, who was like one of the early psychologists, like one of the founders of modern psychology.
William James Hall,
the ugliest building on campus. So,
neighborless podcast. Official.
I wonder if that's like a. yeah. I wonder if that's like a fact on like a tour of campus that people will say that it's
definitely
the ugliest building.
Definitely not the ugliest building.
Mather
is uglier. Science Center is arguably uglier, but by far the ugliest is the Graduate School of Design.
I was just thinking.
Oh,
that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been in there?
Yes,
okay,
I have.
So Rabbi
Jonah took me.
Desks, I think that is a very cool idea. I think
but
it is,
you know,
terrible.
But you know,
as
you
far
know
as
why?
Location.
One reason why it looks like that, allegedly, at least
yeah.
Urban legend goes, is that it looks weird because the stepped roof is facing a building.
Yes.
It was supposed to be the other way, and then they realized that because where the sun was, like, it would have been impossible to be in the building.
Mm-hmm.
At the last minute, they just like rotated the building, and now all the windows and the stairs just face a different building.
They do. It's like a beautiful design. It just makes no sense in the place it is. Also, like, it does not fit in with the rest of the architecture at all.
Yeah, when I went on the official Harvard tour, like when I was visiting campus, they said like Science Center is objectively the ugliest. They've said that on the tour.
Wow.
And every time I pass the tour guys, if they're in the Science Center Plaza, they're talking about how ugly the Science Center is. They're also trying to say how it's supposed to look like a Polaroid camera, but it doesn't.
I have to say, I think Northwest is a lot uglier than the Science Center.
Northwest is so great.
Northwest at least somewhat blends into its surroundings.
it is just like disorienting when you're in there.
It's still not a central location. Well, you don't realize about the Science Center is that if the Science Center were like the fact that the Science Center is ugly cuts campus in half. If the Science Center were a nice building, you would think of like Oxford Street and the yard as being like one continuous pretty stretch.
Right.
Whereas now it's like campus exists in two sections.
Right, the yard and then everything else.
Divided, like two nice sections divided by this one.
And like Annenberg.
It's like the literal worst place on campus for you to put in a new building.
It really is, yeah, because again, it's a pretty central location, especially for incoming students. And where, I mean, everyone goes through Annenberg, so everyone has to approach the Science Center at least one time.
At some point.
Yeah.
I live in the Science Center freshman year.
And now where do you live?
I kind of in Malincard, which is across the street from Science Center, the Chem building.
No, Mazal, you live in Rab.
Oh. My time's kind of half between two buildings. Foho doesn't exist, actually.
Doesn't exist, Foho.
Sarah, Natalie, you're that bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're invalidating their experience.
Yeah. They should work harder to make Foho excited. No,
okay. Okay, yeah, so let's keep going. Let's say the part three of this forward. Paragraph three. Hanitzim Belajen, so Nitzibr, Vatali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, actually tried to see if we had the Merom Esada, which is his commentary on Gemara in the library, which we don't have.
It's Merom Esada, right?
Yeah, it's yeah, they messed it up. I tried to fix all of the things, but
AI isn't quite ready to beat humans at this game.
No, it's not ready, but you know, I appreciate Moshe Kopel putting this thing together, which has made life a lot easier. I did change some of it. Like, I changed this to Higdir, even though the way they vocalized it was incorrect. So, Hanitziv of a legend, Higdir, Shnei Suge Hora'am. Hanitziv said there are two different types of Hora'av, halachic ruling, halachic instruction. So, this is part of his commentary in Horiot. Mesachon Horiot is one of the Mesachtot in Gemara, which deals with the question or the situation in which the Sanhedrin erroneously makes a ruling on halacha, and then all the Jewish people follow this improper, erroneous mistake. It's a really curious mesecha. It's actually pretty short. Aaron Lichtenstein has a commentary on it, so if you want to learn that, it's pretty cool. So in this commentary on Horio, he says there are two, he makes this argument, that there are two different types of Hora'ah, of halachic ruling. And it makes sense, it's talking about Hora'ah in the context of Misachet Horio, which is all about the Beit and Agadol and the Sanhedrin. Number one is Hora'ah l'sha'ata, a ruling that's made for the historical moment, Hamitbasaset al dimoy milta l'milta, which is a halachic ruling based off of halachic inference and analogy. The Rambam in Hilchot Tamid Torah says that being medame milta milta, comparing different halachot and different halachic constructs and seeing how different halachic analogies works, it's like the highest form of Tamid Torah. So this form of Hora'ah l'sha'ata of halachic ruling for a moment or for a historical moment is based off of this of analogy. That's type number one. V'hora'ah l'dorot hamivusaset al pilpula shel Torah. The second type is hora'ah l'dorot, halachic ruling for future generations, which is based on the pilpula shel Torah, which is like the I don't know how to translate this. What did I even write here for pilpula shel Torah? I wrote the ordinary halachic machinations. Pilpul shel Torah, like the idea of like pilpul is like being like very halachically involved, making arguments and making claims and offering hypotheses and going back and forth and making challenges. So that's like the second form. Yeah, Michael.
Okay. Couple related questions. What would be an example of each of these? Relatedly, what is the difference between these? Like, how is the first not a subset of the second? And also relatedly, this seems to be different than how like a Horas Shah is classically defined.
How is it classically defined?
The way I see the term Horas Shah, it's like a one-time ruling which is in contradiction with other halakhic sources, but you know the prophet or whoever is giving the ruling is, you know, nonetheless aware enough of the needs of Klal Yisrael that they're you know, able to make that decision. So a positive example would be Eliyahu HaNavi was able to bring Korbanot on Har HaKarmel, even though it was outside of Beit HaMikdash, because he made a Rosh Hashanah that at this specific moment, you know, the need for me to do this transcends the prohibition of bringing offerings outside of Beit HaMikdash. But yeah, I guess I'm just not really clear what exactly leads me.
Good. I'm glad that it's unclear for you, because I looked up the Nitziv's commentary on Horiyot, and I didn't find that he did a better job of explaining it. Like, there his explaining, his commenting on the Gemara, so that's like a little involved. Yeah, to be honest, I don't really conceptually understand what the differences in these two methods are. What Rav Re'im is trying to point out is that, like, there's a difference between Hora'a L'Shata, which is like, this is like a ruling for a certain historical moment, and like rulings that are meant for like every generation. So I think it's trying to, and the difference between that is like, one is based off of like creating a principles and like a system, that's like Hora'a L'Doro, versus Hora'a L'Shata is like kind of like just making a halakhic argument. Let's say like if you were like justifying something, that's like a practice that the masses, you know, do, that might be like a Hora'a L'Shata. Not exactly, but yeah, exactly. Like what you're describing, like Eliyahu Navi is like, you know, it ratzon yifiru Torah techa, that like because of, you know, this particular historical calamity, so, you know, we needed to you know, scale back the Torah in order to make sure that it's, you know, we're fulfilling it, like vitula hikyuma, by not doing Torah it is the key. Yeah, so I agree with you. Yeah, to be honest, I don't really understand this distinction. I spent some time on this Meron Mesadeh, didn't get too far, so I don't have so much clarity here. Well, I don't think it's super important. I think it's just showing it's important to have like principles that we're using, foundations for thinking about areas in halacha, and not just making like a one-time ruling. I think that's like what it's trying to make. But yeah, I don't fully understand what the argument is making. Were there other questions?
No, just generally confused.
Okay, good. I'm glad you're confused, because I was confused too. And yeah, and it did not really clarify it so much in the source text now. Yeah, I was also like, how did Rav Reim know about this random comment of Nitziv and Horio? Like, I was like, this is crazy. Like, he clearly has a lot of bikkias.
He's a Talmud for Lichtenstein,
yeah, it could be. I'm sure he's also taught Horiyot and Shiva before. This is just like a good shtark drop. This is like a, you know, like, it just shows that you like really know a lot of Torah. Like, it's a pretty obscure reference. It's not so obscure, but it's pretty out there. Okay. So he said, okay, so let's continue. He says, Kedeli it's modid in tchuma chadash zeh, in order to deal with, to grapple with this new domain, this new area of halacha, uliasi darchei hora'a shetamdona ledorot, in order to solidify hora'a psak halacha that will stand the test of time for generations, yesh lahagdir et mekorot yisodiim shecholim l'shamish kishorashim mutzakim lahalacha. There is a need to define the foundational sources that can be used as solid principles for halacha. In other words, it's saying we need to have some sort of more systematic approach. We need to have principles for thinking about mental health, mental illness, and halacha. So now he gives a suggestion. So this is why I think it's pretty bold, and this will take up the rest of our time together. Lefi aniyut dati, according to my humble opinion, echad ha-mikorot ha-shorashim li-yitzirat anfei halacha rabim ha-mivusasim lo rak al ha-atzalat ha-guf ha-mayadit hu shitat Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya. My humble opinion, he says, one of the core sources that I think can be used to build, you know, a broader halachic framework is the position that's not focused on the immediate physical danger, you know, pikuach nefesh model that we had before, but rather is focused on something else, is the position of Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya, which was, Madua yesh l'chilel l'chalel Shabbat l'tzorech hatzalat nefeshot, which is why, what is the source for violating Shabbat in order to save someone's life? So the Gemara Masechet Yoma and Daf Pei Hei Amud Aleph and Amud Bet discusses actually an interesting conversation. There's a kind of a story about a variety of or a bunch of Tanaim that are like walking together and having a conversation. And it starts off by asking, like, what's the source for Bikuach Nefesh? What's the source in the Torah that tells us that pikuach nefesh is doche Shabbos, that something that's life-threatening danger allows us to violate Shabbos in order to save someone's life. So one of the positions or advocate, and there must be six or seven, something like that, different positions advocated and sources advocated, is the position of Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh. Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh Omer, Vishamru b'nei Yisrael ta Shabbat, he cites the pasuk that the Jewish people kept the Shabbat or should keep the Shabbat. Right, we know lasot the Shabbat l'dor tam b'rit olam, they should keep Shabbat for future generations forever. Amrat Torah, the Torah says, Chalal alav Shabbat echad, you should violate one Shabbat, kidei shishmor Shabbatot arbei, in order so that you can keep more Shabbatot. Right, v'shamru b'nei Yisrael at the Shabbat, the Jewish people should keep the Shabbat, is the source that tells us that one should violate Shabbat one time in order to observe Shabbat, to keep Shabbat on many other occasions. Right, so this principle is the idea of like, we're going to sacrifice this one Shabbat, you're not going to keep Shabbat properly the Shabbat, based off of the idea that in the future, you're going to keep a lot more Shabbatot. So that's the idea of Bikuach Nefesh here, of Rosh Shimon ben Manasseh. Make sense? Be'od nimukim nusafim sham b'sugya, there are more rationales that are advocated in the Gemara there. L'chalal Shabbat al-Bikuach Nefesh, to violate Shabbat al-Bikuach Nefesh. U'b'roshan divrei Shmuel. Shmuel is of the position, Shmuel is the Amora that we accept his position and his derivation of this rule, which is the Torah says, V'chai b'hem, and you should live by the laws of the Torah. And we learn from the fact that it says, V'chai b'hem, v'lo she'amut b'hem, and you shouldn't die by them. You should live by them and you shouldn't die by them. That is the source that's asku ba'atzalah ha'mayadit shel haguf. That is the source that's concerned about the immediate physical danger to the body that is life-threatening. Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh ma'amid lo rak et erech ha'chayim mul ha'mavet. Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh doesn't just put up the value conflict of life and death, right? Ela matziv shikul adifut shel chilul Shabbat zmani l'tzorech chayim shleimu mitukanim yoter ba'atid. But rather, in his calculation, Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh, right, he says, Chalal alav Shabbat echad kidei shishmor Shabbatot arbei, violate one Shabbat to keep more Shabbatot. His calculation considers the temporary violation of Shabbat in order to live a life that is more full, that is more holistic. Right? So his focus isn't just the immediate danger, but his thinking also into the future. It's not just about me being able to do Shabbat today, but it's thinking about Shabbat next week, and the week after that, and the month after that, and the year after that. Has a much more future-oriented approach. Al af shela halacha, v'chai b'hem shevelo she'b'yamut b'hem, hu ha'makor ikari. So even though, on a practical halachic level, we don't follow Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh, but rather we follow Shmuel, whose derivation is v'chai b'hem. Yesh li t'yacheis l'kol ha'makoru b'suya, kol echad mehem k'shikul atzma'i, we should approach all of the different sources and derivations in the Gemara about Pikuach Nefesh as valuable in and of themselves, and also the consequences that arise as a result of those positions. Meaning, to say this somewhat differently, halachically, halacha l'maaseh, practically, when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, we don't follow Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh's position that you should violate one Shabbat in order to keep many more Shabbatot. That's not how we follow Shmuel, who says, V'chai b'hem v'lo she'amut b'hem. That's his ruling. But Rav Reim is saying, even though that's, when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, that's the case, we shouldn't discredit or we shouldn't disqualify Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh's position in its rationale. And he says, in fact, Kaf nifsak l'dorot k'dat b'hag, we follow the position of the b'hag, Sheyesh lahatzil ubar b'Shabbat, av she'ein ubar dinei nefesh be'ofen malei. We're allowed to. The Shulchan Aruch says you're allowed to save, or the Shulchan Aruch, which follows the Bahag, says you're allowed to save a fetus on Shabbat, even though a fetus isn't considered a full human being, halachically speaking. It's not halachically defined as a full human being. Which means that's all the way back to Sarah's chabura on abortion many months ago. Good shalom then, big crowd, a lot of learning there. So even though the fetus isn't considered a full halachic person, Mikevan shu atid lishmor shabbat. Since the ubar, since this fetus is eventually going to be a person, a full person, halakhically speaking, and this is going to be a person that keeps shabbat, so you're allowed to violate shabbat for this fetus, which isn't considered a full halakhic person, because in the future it will be a full halakhic person. So in other words, Rabbi Shimon ben Asiyah's position kind of exists in another area of halakha. Yeah, Abby.
What if it's like a fetus that doesn't keep Shabbos? What if it's like a non-Jewish baby? What is the acceptable kind of course of action there? Because if they're not keeping Shabbat, how are there nefeshes thought of, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And that's one of the arguments that's made about abortion is that this halacha that says that the way that we conceptualize fetuses not necessarily as a full person, or aborting fetuses as a full person, it's not necessarily murder, so there are more grounds for leniency. But I would say, likely, that according to this position of the Bahag, you wouldn't be able to violate Shabbat for this non-Jewish fetus. That's according to the position of the Bahag. Practically speaking, what's our position? I don't know. That's a good question. Have to review what Sarah said. But yeah, you make a very good point. So that's one position when it comes to saving a fetus on Shabbat. And then he brings up another example. But Ofen Domeh, similarly, Hechriach Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, in the Beit Yosef. Are people familiar with the Beit Yosef as a sefer? Yeah, Beit Yosef was Rabbi Yosef Karo's huge commentary on the Torah, which he then turned in. He then wrote the Shulchan Aruch, which is the concise version of that. So, in the Beit Yosef, the Mechaber Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote, "Shiyesh lechalal Shabbat lahatzil yeled mihishtamdut." That one is allowed to violate Shabbat to save a child from assimilation, from intermarriage. So this is a pretty fascinating case.
You ever do that here at Hill?
Oh man, it's I guess there's yesh la'ayin of what the implications are. Right, so the Beit Yosef says, Yesh lechalal shabbat lehatzil yel mishtamdut, from assimilation. Af she'ein b'kach hatzalat haguf bilvad, even though one isn't just saving you're not just saving a person from immediate physical danger, but rather are saving a person from spiritual danger. Okay, we're going to take a pause from here. We're going to flip the page over now. So this is what I did. I brought some sources that really explain what's going on here. Right, so here's the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef, I brought the text of the Beit Yosef here, and really this is a case of the Rashba. The Rashba is asked a question. Nishalah Rashba alachat sheshalchulo b'Shabbat. One time somebody, received a messenger on Shabbat, or there was somebody who came on Shabbat, shehotzi'u bito b'chazakam bito, that somebody came and just abducted his daughter on Shabbat from his house. Al yidei Yisrael Mumar, from an irreligious Jew, or a Jew who's no longer religiously committed, on an ideological level. Lohotia miklal Yisrael, in order to abduct her and to keep her from being religiously committed, to living a Jewish religious lifestyle. So the question is asked to the Rashba was, Im yasim laderech pama b'shabbat, pin yafchiduha, this vocalization is incorrect, yafchiduha lahamir, that
that's totally correct.
Yeah,
that's totally correct.
Yeah,
that she could be they will scare her into.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. You're right. It is yafchiduha. It is. Yeah. It is. They will. Yeah. They'll scare her. So right. The question. So the question that he was asked is, can you chase after her on Shabbat, even three parsa'ot, which is the distance one's allowed to travel on Shabbat, assuming that they're going to scare her to reject Judaism and to no longer be halakhically committed. which is Lamanda Omer the Tchum Gimel Parsa Uto Raita, assuming that this is a Isser Do Raita. Okay. Mi dachina misafik zeh ta shabbat ki dachina misafik nevashot. Says the Rashba has asked, does this safek, does this question, is this similar to a case of safik nevashot, of somebody whose life is an immediate danger, physical danger? Should we rule the same way here, that in this case, since there's immediate, there's going to be future spiritual danger, that that this person can be mechel al shabbat, they can violate shabbat in order to save his daughter? Ve'yeshiva davar, he answered, the Rashba answered, Tarif tamud, you need a source. Umikom akom kach da'ati notah she'ein dochin shabbat alata meha avirot. And the Beit Yosef says, and I kind of lean, my own thinking is I lean toward not violating shabbat to save someone from avirot. Okay, but if we continue in the Beit Yosef, he goes through a whole analysis, and he ultimately says, second to last line, v'hilkach chalaleh at shabbat tefakech aleha shari u'mitzvah nami ika, is a mitzvah to save her on shabbat, to violate shabbat in order to save her. V'ilo bai l'me'abed kaifinan lain, even if the father doesn't want to go after her to save her, he has to. So ultimately, the position that the Beit Yosef cites here is the position of Tosfot. So he paskins like Tosfot against the Rashba, in this case of abduction on Shabbat. And the Shulchan Aruch, which is right beneath the Beit Yosef, he writes this and codifies this position of Tosfot, that one is allowed to violate Shabbat to save one's child who is abducted and potentially won't keep Torah and Mitzvot anymore. In the Magen Avraham, in the third source on this page, explicitly explains that the reason for this is based off the principle of Rabbi Shimon ben Manasya, where he writes, "Afilu manda amei dehavi doraita." Even if you hold that walking gimel parson on Shabbat is an iser doraita, shari, one is allowed to violate Shabbat to save one's daughter. To legabe shlo tamar v'tavid kol yamei chilul Shabbat, so that she won't become irreligious and violate Shabbat her entire life. Ze isura zuta, this is a small isur, meaning to violate Shabbat this one's time, so that she won't do a much greater violation of Shabbat by always breaking Shabbat. Dimutav l'chalal Shabbat achat k'deishi shetishmor Shabbatot tarbe. It's better to break Shabbat, to violate Shabbat one time in order to have more Shabbatot in the future. So in other words, we practically, even though when it comes to pikuach nefesh, as a halakha concept, we don't accept Rav Shimon ben Manasya, this idea of violating one Shabbat to have to keep Shabbatot in the future. In other areas, in similar areas in halakha, this principle actually does exist and is a meaningful, practical principle. Okay. So that is basically that's how Rav Reim closes this paragraph. So, in essence, this third argument that he makes is that if we use this principle of Chalal alav Shabbat achat kidei shishmor Shabbatot arbei, that one should violate one Shabbat in order to save more Shabbatot, if we use that as a principle or foundation for certain certain mental health challenges, obstacles, or mental health illnesses, this is something that seems to be ripe as a source for permitting violating Shabbat. Like one of the things Rav Yoni said tonight is that he's been asked before if someone can listen to music, somebody who's suffering from depression can listen to music on Shabbat, whether they're allowed to do that. So this potentially, if this is a precedent for violating Shabbat, or another example he gave is somebody who journals that helps them process and cope with those, with their feelings or with their depression, could they do that on Shabbat? So potentially this could be a source, this idea of Chalal of Shabbat Achat, Kadei Shishmor Shabbatot Tarbei, this could be a source for, you know, that type of thing. So ultimately, I hope, I'll get to Michael's question in a second, just to kind of review what we saw, Rav Reim means three main points. The first point is, we live at a time where we better understand mental health, mental illness than previously, and therefore requires us thinking about and rethinking the place that mental health occupies and mental illness occupies in halacha. Claim number two, point number two, is that previously in halacha, even though there are times where mental health and mental illness is taken into consideration, it's often thought about not in terms of the illness itself or of the internal experience of psychological distress or illness, but rather it's thought about the immediate physical danger that's caused by that psychological illness. And the third point is, we have this position from Mishum Mamunasya, that of chalal lav Shabbat chat kedei shishmor Shabbatot tarbei, that you should violate Shabbat one time in order to be able to keep Shabbat on many other occasions, which, even though it's rejected in its context, actually is the position that we follow in other contexts. And so perhaps that might be a source for thinking about mental health or mental illness, whether it's on Shabbat specifically or in other areas of halacha, where perhaps violating halacha in this area now might be beneficial for being able to keep it in the future. Yeah, Michael.
So, I worked at one of the elementaries this year, so forgive me if it's something that was covered, but the two examples that you gave, it seemed to be like a pretty big leap from these. Whereas like here, it's something there's, you know, a pretty clear one-to-one correlation that if you leave the tchum to go save this girl, then you bring her back into the fold, and if you don't, then she's gone. She's a Christian now. And like similarly for the saving a life thing, you know, if you save this person's life, then they will be alive for future Shabbos, and if you don't, then they will die before next Shabbos. Or something like the journaling of the music case, not at all to minimize the role that, you know, such things can have for someone who is suffering mental illness, but there's undeniably a less direct cause and effect between that action and between like their life. It's like, what's the rationale for sort of expanding this principle? Expanding it.
Yeah, it's a really great question. So one thing that Ravioni brought up, which is really interesting in this context specifically, is that somebody with depression asked him about whether they could listen to music and take hot showers. Those are like the two things that they would use to cope with their depression on Shabbat. So Rav Yoni said to them, well, this isn't like something that just started today. Like, this has been going on for you for a while, I'm assuming. Like, what have you been doing previously? And so this person said that they were cutting themselves and I think vomiting?
Yeah.
Inducing vomiting. As a way to deal with those emotions and feelings. So one of the things, so I think that's like an example of like, this is actually like is, a physical danger. And the cutting themselves, this person knew how to cut themselves in a way that wasn't actually like immediately life-threatening. But the idea of like, these are, you know, two things which like potentially in the long run, like are life-threatening. So I agree with you. I think that, like you would have to, and Rune didn't say exactly, like he didn't give his psak in both of these cases. But I think something like this would be like actually amazing precedent for a case like that. It would make a lot of sense to be the basis for a case like that.
The details change the
100%, 100%, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing is just sharing something that actually Leah Baron shared with me once that apparently Usher Weiss, which is like interesting in its own right because, you know, radio world's a little bit behind on this stuff, wrote that if someone has OCD about dominating, that they shouldn't dominate. That was very interesting.
Yeah. I was actually just talking to a friend about that before the shir. He brought up that tshuva. Usher Weiss talks about OCD. Usher Weiss is one of the poskim that Rav Yoni sought after in his book. So, like, throughout this book, they're like major poskim that are cited. So it's like Rav Usher Weiss, Rav Baruch Gigi, Rav Herschel Schechter, Rav Mordechai Willig, Rav Eliezer Melamed, like big poskim from a variety of different communities. I hope I don't miss anything. Rav Nachum Rabinovich. So he asked like a lot of a variety of poskim. So Rav Usher Weiss is one of them. Yeah, it's interesting. I think in the Israeli Haredi world, Rav Usher Weiss is like one of the more prominent rabbis who've written on mental health and mental illness in halacha. In America, there's another rabbi, Rav David Cohen, not to be confused with the famous Kashrut Rabbi David Cohen, has written many books about kashrut supervision, halacha. Not to be confused, but there's a Rav David Cohen who's really one of the you know, huge post-game in the Haredi community, who also deals with, who also answers a lot of these questions. The book that, one of the halacha and psychotherapy books that I have, which I'm not totally satisfied with, is actually like a lot of his the rulings come from Rav David Cohen. But yeah, it's really interesting. Asher Weiss says that like someone shouldn't daven in that case. There are a lot of really fascinating conclusions. Yeah.
Yeah, I think like one of the most interesting points that's made here, and then also like going back to Rav Yoni Shir earlier, is this idea that like this is not a permanent solution. Like violating Shabbat, that's like not the goal of this. And I think that's like really stressed by this text, and then also by the Yom Kippur example he gave earlier. So like basically, it was this idea that like, some rabbis hold that if you suffer from an eating disorder and you never have to fast on Yom Kippur, and like there's no reason to ever fast. And I think what he said was something that I really agree with, that like telling someone who, you know, struggled with anorexia, struggled with bulimia, struggled with any kind of eating disorder, that they can never fast on Yom Kippur is basically telling them that they're never going to get better and they're always going to be sick. And, you know, providing that option for them and providing like, that option for people who are struggling with depression, struggling with anxiety to, violate Shabbat or, you know, break the fast on your keyboard is very valid. But there's also a stress on seeking out help and seeking out avenues through which to get better so you can kind of come back to keeping Shabbat or holding fast on Yom Kippur. Like, I think that was really also really interesting, and I think that's really also really stressed here. So I think it's a really beautiful thing. It's not like you get to break Shabbat all the time. It's like this, just like if you need to for like a compelling reason, whether it be mental or physical, like there's room for you, but there's always this kind of emphasis on coming back to halacha, which I think is beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's a really important component to this, which is like the idea is like trying to live a life that is full, and that you don't always like Rav Yoni. He said tonight, and he said other times written this as well, that like he doesn't give people like an answer like you should do this always for your whole life. Like he doesn't say like, oh, you should always not keep Shabbat forever. Like there's, you know, people do get better. People do get to a place where, you know, they may not need that. So I think it's also like what you're saying. It's really important for people being able to return to optimal mental health, to know that like they can get better and it's possible to get better. I think that's a really important point.
I think a new thing about this.